You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Joining me on this Monday is Alex Hollins. Alex, how you doing?
Not bad, man. How are you doing?
I'm all right. What, Merry Christmas? Do you do Christmas, or do you do something else? Like, what's your deal?
It's weird, because I'm a pretty religion-averse guy to be as into Christmas as I am. I fucking love Christmas. I'm not a big religion guy. My wife is a pretty religious person, which benefits my love for Christmas, you know. But I grew up in a house that was split between Protestant and Catholicism, you know. So my parents settled on just nobody's right. Everybody go to bed. But we always did Christmas really big in my house. It was always a chance for us to, not necessarily about presents, but we definitely did, I'd say, go overboard on presents for a family as poor as we were, you know. But I like that the Christmas season is just an excuse to be in a good mood, you know. It's a good reason to do nice things for people and give people the benefit of the doubt, you know. So, yeah, we definitely do Christmas around here. My house is all Christmased out. My daughter loves it.
Listen to you.
I know, I'm an awfully cynical guy to be this into Christmas, right?
Yeah, this is like, why am I struggling with this?
It's the one time a year that I'm not a cynical bastard, where I'm like, hey, you know, maybe we ought to give a little bit of money to that charity and be decent human beings. And then 3 weeks from now, I'll be like, forget everybody. Lock the doors. You know, but with Christmas time is that one time a year that I acknowledge the existence of other humans.
Wow. I don't want to say I'm shocked, because everybody's got their, you know, their own little idiosyncrasies that they live with, and so it's just interesting to hear yours.
You know, in large part, I grew up real, real poor for a long time, and I distinctly remember how big a deal it was when people did, like, little things for my family. My parents were never the type that would accept any kind of help from anybody, you know? But every once in a while, you know, some gifts would show up at the door, things like that, you know? And I remember what a big deal that was, you know? So whenever I'm at the grocery store now and they do those, like, oh, do you want to donate $5 for a box of food? Or, hell yeah, I want to donate $5. Let's do 10. You know, I love Toys for Tots. That's why I participated in it so much when I was in the Marine Corps. And I don't know. I love Christmas time, man, which is weird because as I mentioned, I'm not a very overtly religious person. But I think that people tend to think of Christmas as either a Christian holiday, you know, about Christ, or a commercial holiday. And I really like to embrace the idea that it's just about, you know, being good human beings and helping each other out.
Well, it could be. There's nothing that says that there's some kind of mutual exclusion about the nature of Christmas, yay?
Right? I agree. I think Christmas can be whatever you and your family want it to be, you know?
Now, there's going to be people that push back on that, but...
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
But we don't care about that. Like, you don't care about that.
I don't, honestly. And because, in my opinion, I try really hard to respect people's religions, and if you have a very Christ-centric view of Christmas, there's nothing wrong with that. That's rad. That's an awesome way to spend the day, you know?
Now, but let me ask you this. All your curmudgeon-y, and you love Christmas, but being a curmudgeon and whatnot, when you have a kid, and now your daughter is old enough, right?
She's just turned two, so she gets it. This year is the first Christmas that she, like, understands that there's presents that are going to happen. The rest of it kind of seems a little foreign to her, but she's excited. But she definitely understands that presents are coming.
Does she understand the concept of Santa Claus?
I think she does. I'm telling you, man, I think every parent says this, but my kid is a freaking genius. But I do think that she gets that Santa...
I never said that.
I think that she gets that Santa is who brings the presents. But I have actually... I'm glad I have an opportunity to discuss this. I have very strong feelings about the elf on the shelf. This is an elfless household.
Oh.
I don't buy into that mass surveillance, let's train our kids to live in China bullshit. There's no elf on the shelf in this house. In my house, it's all about do the right thing even when nobody's looking. So I'm not going to teach her that in December, though, somebody's looking.
No, you know? They're looking all the time.
They're never looking. Don't count on people checking up on you to do the right thing.
Oh,
I don't want to.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm not blackmailing my kid. I don't want to. You know, I've only got a 2-year-old. God knows how this will survive when she's 6.
It's the same. It's the same thing.
But I'm not going to bribe my kid to try to do good things. That's not what I want her to think is the reason to do the right thing. I really want to try to encourage her to see Christmas as a holiday about helping each other out and giving to one another, not necessarily a quid pro quo about your behavior last month, but more about, you know, do the right thing this month. You know?
Well, let me tell you, I've got a recommendation for you. And that is to make volunteering during the Christmas season part of what you do as a family. Now,
awesome idea.
Well, she's a little bit too young, but let me just tell you, when we did this as a family and we had teenagers in the house and down to Colleen was maybe, you know, 5 or 6, and I was on the city council and I do my radio show. So I was like Mayor McCheese of this town. And so we, you know, through our church had this gigantic, community event on, I believe it was Christmas Eve. And, they would open up the gym at the school and they served turkey, and up on the stage there was a big Christmas tree and there was Christmas presents all over the place.
And I'm telling you, as a guy who grew up in a trailer where turkey sandwiches were what we had on Christmas some years, that's a huge deal.
Oh, well, and again, and then what they did was, you know, for people that can't get out of their house, they deliver dinner to there. And then if you have mobility issues, they'll go and you'll pick people up and bring them. And let me just tell you, I've told this story before and I'll tell it again, but my 17-year-old son, I think it was a senior in high school, Patrick, number 2, and Colleen were with me, and we went to deliver meals. And so we go to this developmental home, and it's this huge apartment complex, right? Now, these are the places that you don't know are in your town, most people. And so we go in, and we knew, because we had volunteered at Special Olympics, we knew some of the people that were in the lobby. And so we come in with, like, I don't know, all this food. And we have it in shopping carts because they were out in the parking lot. And it's probably 5 degrees above zero, snow in North Dakota and all that, and in late December. And we come in, and Patrick sees people he knows, and he's saying hi, and we go up and we knock on a door, and a man in a walker answers with an oxygen tank on the walker with a tube, you know, going into his nose, I think. And I swear to God, it was like 86 degrees in the apartment. The TV's on really loud. Wife is a single amputee playing solitaire with cards, right? Not on an iPad or anything like that, but like old fashioned hardcore solitaire, right? At a card table with a stack of newspapers, I swear to God, went up to the ceiling. He answers the door, and we said, hi, how you doing? And he said, where you been? You're late. And we said, well, we had to, you know, snowing, so we had to drive slow, but they're backed up at the kitchen. He says, all right, well, I hope you brought the ice cream this year. And Colleen is 6, and she looks up at him and says, hi, I'm Colleen. And he says, hi, Colleen. And Patrick says, the ice cream's right here. So we give them their food, right? And we do maybe 5 other versions of that at the developmental home place, right? Now, we return the cart to the lobby. We're walking back out to the car. And my 17-year-old senior in high school son looks at me and says, you know something? I said, what? And he said, I don't need anything for Christmas. I said, what do you mean? He said, I'm pretty lucky. Now,
you know, and that really is what it's all about. I don't mean
but you can't
that it's all about not wanting something, but
no.
About understanding how lucky you are.
Well,
you know?
and so to me, you can't lecture them to that, right?
No, I agree.
You've got to rub their snout in it. And so to me, that's why you volunteer in the community, because you'll have conversations on the way home. We went and picked up a woman to bring her to dinner. We walk up, we knock on the door, she's blind, and she answers the door. And I said, hi, I'm Mike, and this is my son Patrick, and we're here to take you to St. Mike's to the community meal. And she said, okay, let me just put my coat on. And so we walk. She said, come on in. So we walk into the foyer of her apartment, and she's putting her coat on. And it's amazing, right? People that are visually challenged, right? They do stuff the same way, right? And she puts her cane in the same place. She grabs her coat. She's doing her coat. And she looks at me and says, you're Mike McNamara.
She knew your voice.
And I said, no, I'm not. she says, yes, you are. And you have a son named Patrick. I said, oh, so just because I have a son named Patrick, you think I'm Mike McNamara? Like, who is that anyway?
Just because I have a son named Patrick and this incredible radio voice?
She says, it's you. I know it. I said, well, you're crazy. And her name is Mary. She said, no, I'm not. I listen to you every day. I said, well, Mary, look, you have bad ears, okay? It happens to people. You should get them checked. And so she's laughing, right? And we're walking out to the car, right? And so she's so excited to go to dinner. And it's, if you'll do that with your kids and not lecture them, your kids will understand the true meaning of Christmas, and they won't, you know, be pissed that they didn't get the latest, you know, set of earbuds for their iPhone at the end of it. They'll understand how lucky they are. They'll understand what it's about. But I don't think you can lecture your way to that. You got to go out and do it.
To that same effect, we didn't volunteer because we were poor as hell. What we did, we worked. You know, my dad was a big fat guy with a beard, so he was Santa every year for Christmas. And as soon as I was old enough, I was an elf every year for Christmas, you know? And let me tell you the appreciation that you will develop for Christmas, even despite having to wear green tights as an 11-year-old boy. When you go and you see other kids that are coming to see Santa, coming to see your dad, to ask your dad for the things that they want. And a lot of times, you know, the trope is that kids go and they ask for a really expensive toy, or they ask for like a big crazy toy. A lot of times they don't. A lot of times kids ask for very simple things. All I want's a truck, you know? I did not see any of those heartbreakers, you know, where that kid goes up and is like, I just want my daddy back or something terrible. That never happened to me, fortunately. But, I mean, kid after kid would show up.
And
you know,
as an elf, you didn't feel it was your moral responsibility to look at those kids and say, yo, bro, this is just a hoax, man. He's my dad. He's just a fat guy.
No, well, you know, I had an older brother, so I never had the benefit of believing in Santa, you know, because my older brother was an asshole. But I always thought it was cool other people did. I didn't feel the need to ruin somebody else's fun, especially because I had like this vague idea that I had gotten from TV that the guys that played Santa had this way of relaying the information to whoever it was pertinent to. I still didn't, even though I didn't believe in Santa, I was like, I don't know where these kids get their presents. I don't know how it works. So in my own weird childish way, I think I was playing a part in the system. I don't know. But no, man, you don't want to ruin people's Christmas cheer. You don't want to ruin the fun. I would even assume that a number of those kids that are there to see Santa don't believe in Santa. You know, that's not really what it's about. It's about getting a picture with a guy dressed up like Santa Claus. You know, we took a picture with my daughter and the world's skinniest Santa at Petco yesterday. You know, and I told her when we were leaving, I was like, that scrawny dude's not Santa. Just so you know. CrossFit Santa's not real, okay?
Right. Like, you know, but and there's another real interesting discussion. When do you tell your kids there's no Santa?
See, I don't know, man, because I was of the camp where I thought we should never tell her there is a Santa. We should just tell her the truth right off the bat. And my wife, on the other hand, doesn't hate fun like I do, and was like, "The hell are you talking about, man?" Like. First of all, she's 2 years old. This is a discussionable shelf for another year.
We don't need to have this one this year.
Yeah. Second of all, like, do you want her to be the weird, like, depressed kid at Christmas when all the other kids are like, oh, Santa's coming? Who's just like, there is no Santa.
Yeah, come on.
And I don't know, man. I don't want to do that.
You don't want her to be like that, okay?
But I also don't – I'm not sure that I like – I don't like – I think I'll be cool with the idea of Santa. I'm just not going to blackmail her with Santa, giving her coal or crap like that. I don't buy into that stuff.
No.
First and foremost, coal's valuable, man. We could use some. So I'll sell that shit on the black market, pay some bills. I don't know.
What happens is she'll go to school, and there'll be a kid that has older brothers and sisters who stands up in front of everybody and says – Yeah, there's no such thing as Santa. Right?
Exactly.
Like the asshole in preschool. And
well,
like,
I don't want my kid to be that kid either.
Yeah, you don't want that.
You know? So.
No, you want your kid to be the victim of that, and then she looks at you with tears in her eyes, and you say, what's wrong, honey? And she said, Daddy, Alex Holling said there's no Santa.
Exactly.
And then let's go get some ice cream. Let me have a
somebody
talk.
Asked me recently why I don't have an elf on the shelf for my kid, and I was like, because mine's good.
What is elf on the shelf? I don't even understand that.
So the elf on the shelf is this thing that a lot of parents are doing now, where it's like this little elf that you set up in different places around your house, and every night you're supposed to change where the elf is to trick your kid into thinking that the elf is moving around at night. And the idea is that the elf is keeping an eye on your kid and reporting back to Santa whether they're naughty or nice. So the elf on the shelf is like a really popular thing among parents in my age group, and I can't stand the very premise of it, you know? It's a concern of mine, too, because nowadays every kid's got an elf on the shelf, so people are going to, you know, my kid's going to come home and say, Daddy, Daddy, why don't I have an elf on the shelf?
Well, can I tell you the problem? Can I tell you the bigger problem with that?
I'm all ears.
Yeah, let me paint for you the Reefer Madness version of that. The reason that the suicide problem is what it is in this country is that people can't cope. It's not mental health. Right, it's that people who don't have what is called classic mental health are overwhelmed by life, and the reason they're overwhelmed by life is because of shitty parenting and shitty leaders in school, and
a
then
lack
they
of coping mechanisms.
Oh, they can't cope, and what they can't cope with is this: they don't know to do the right thing because doing the right thing is important. They don't know to be tough because life is going to shit on you. What they believe is that their feelings count. That if they're good, somebody will give them something, and that's why you're good. You're not good because that's the right thing to do. You're good because you'll get something, okay?
Exactly. I do not like this.
Oh, it fucks them up. It raises them to be something that's not good, because the only reason I'm going to be good is because I'm going to get something back, right? And it's the wrong way to parent. And ultimately what happens is you excrete out of high school people that have this skewed view of the world, this overimportance of my feelings, right? This moral compass that's anemic, right? And they don't have the toughness that is required when you have to eat turkey sandwiches for Christmas or Thanksgiving or fucking both. And so then what happens? I can't do this. I'm out. And that's why the numbers go up.
To note that even those of us, I would argue, that have developed good coping skills, being able to cope is a perishable skill.
Oh.
You know, if you lead a rather comfortable life for a while, and then things get rocky again, even though you might have been the toughest dude in the world when you were 21, you might have slept with rocks for pillows and gone through breakups without shedding a tear, but at 38, you might react differently. You know what I mean? But I would agree with you completely that if you don't develop these skills, if you don't have bad days when you're young in a scalable level, you never develop those mechanisms that you need to manage bad days when you're older. You know? This is honestly my argument against marijuana. And I'm not against the legalization of marijuana among adults. As far as I'm concerned, it's not really any different than alcohol. But I am fervently against marijuana use among children, aside from, you know, studies about mental development and things. But my bigger concern is that a lot of people use alcohol, just like they use marijuana, to cope with bad feelings. Or I would argue, to avoid coping with bad feelings. And that's a really dangerous precedent to set.
Well, not only is it dangerous, it's a Mensa event, okay? It's part of natural selection because, Alex, let me ask you a trivia question. How many people have successfully dealt with life's trauma by using alcohol and drugs?
Well, I mean, it all depends on how you determine successfully.
How
you mean,
many? Yeah, answer the question.
To 10 more years
fucking zero. Zero.
If success.
What happens?
What 10 years of dying of cirrhosis of the liver.
What
I mean,
happens to all that shit that you've suppressed and you're struggling to deal with when you dump alcohol and drugs into your body?
I would contend that self-medicating is never the answer. Whether it's alcohol, whether it's marijuana, whether it's Kratom, which is a real big popular thing.
Let me tell you this. Worse than being not the answer, it enables the things that destroy your life. That's what they do. So all these things that you kind of have controlled and you're working on when you're sober, when you dump alcohol and drugs into your body, the governor comes off that shit. And the worst part is it doesn't come for you. The people that love you, your significant other, your children, your friends, you annihilate them because that shit comes out and you blast everybody. So
I don't know. That was I can't agree with that completely.
It doesn't matter. You can deny reality all you want.
I think that you're denying some elements of reality, like the way that there are a lot of drugs that are used in conjunction with therapy to really benefit people who are going through difficult times.
That's not what we're talking about.
But a lot of times those are the same drugs that people self-medicate.
We're talking about abusing.
I don't agree with self-medicating.
We're talking about abusing and self-medicating.
Agreed. Abusing
not
is never
prescription never. Under the direction of a physician to
but
help you
get to a
certain
But I wouldn't agree that all prescriptions
place.
Under the direction of a physician are good for you either. I guess is the reason why I think it's important to make some delineations. You know, the same way I got plenty of opioid prescriptions from the VA after leaving the Marine Corps. Just because the doctor signed off on it doesn't mean it was a good idea.
No, but who's the most important part of that equation?
You.
Thank you.
Personally. You've got to take responsibility.
And you've got to ask hard questions. If you don't like it, if the dosage is fucking you up, or if you don't know how you're going to get on it, you be an adult. What we tend to do, especially Marines, is we throw the shit away and we don't go back. Wrong. Or we take it and we give it to somebody else so they can abuse it. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Be an adult. Go back and say, hey, Doc, I need to give this shit back to you because I don't like it. Is there something else that I can do? Different dosage, different drugs, homeopathic shit, acupuncture to help me deal with this. You know, and allow them to help you. But we tend to be horrible patients. I'm not sure where he went. Maybe he muted himself. Oh, it says the call ended. What was that? Hello?
I am terribly sorry. Comcast and I have just not been getting along these past few months, I guess.
Wow.
My internet dropped off and came back up.
All right, well, that's all right. That's all right. Where were we?
I think that we were still yelling and screaming about Christmas, but
we were talking about how shitty patients that Marines tend to be. Instead of having a grown-up conversation with a physician with drugs.
Oh, that reminds me of a very important point that you brought up. I wanted to make sure that I addressed when you said asking the hard questions.
Well, let me just finish it. So instead of, because I want you to hear this, if they give you things that you don't like, or that you've read stuff about that you don't like, or you don't know how you're going to get off them, or then you go back. They're trying to help you, okay? Unless you're dealing with a criminal, and I hopefully that's not the case, and you can figure that out. But if you're dealing with somebody that wants to help you, give them a chance to help you and have an adult conversation with them. Men are horrible at this. Marine men are terrible. Women tend to be more comfortable with having questions because their bodies are more complex and they've had more uncomfortable discussions with physicians than men have. We run from it and we just say, well, fuck it, I'm not going back. And sometimes we give the drugs to other people, sometimes we just throw them away, right? Give them a chance to help you. So I say this, you cannot medicate yourself to a good place, but medication may be part of getting you to the good place. And you've got to do that with the help and support of somebody who you're not afraid to have a conversation with. And that's what I think Alex is talking about.
Yeah, that idea of those hard questions that you're talking about. A big problem that I faced, especially because – so my transition out of the military was ripe with doctors, right? I had 5 surgeries over the span of about 2 years and got medically separated right like maybe a week and a half after the last of those surgeries. So – not only was I spending a lot of time with doctors, but I was spending a lot of time medicated, you know, during that whole period of time. But the transition for me going from military doctors on base to civilian doctors off base was a strange one, and I think it exemplifies an issue that a lot of people have getting medical care post-military, and that is we still see doctors as a lieutenant colonel or as a commander. that we're talking to in uniform, which is the way it is when you're on active duty. When you're a corporal or a lance corporal, you're speaking to a commander about your medical problems, and there's still a certain degree of decorum that's expected of you.
And there
you
shouldn't know? Be. And
there shouldn't be, but there is.
But you know what I'm saying? And it's tough, especially on junior enlisted Marines. Look, that's your doctor, okay? You owe them military courtesy, but if you're uncomfortable with something there,
you've got to be able to voice it.
That you've got to, and if you're not comfortable voicing to them, you walk straight into your first sergeant's office, your platoon sergeant's office, and you tell them. And I talk about this. This is one of the things that I would tell you that since I started doing post-traumatic winning, has expanded the most, and that is wellness, learning how to meditate. I call it, I have my own acronym for this thing that I teach, okay? And it's called GMFBR, right? It's a technique. It's a mental wellness technique, GMFBR. And what that stands for is getting my brain fucking right. And so I watched the guy who pitched for the Cincinnati Reds for my dad do it. And I didn't really know what he was doing until I asked him. And he'd give up a home run, Tom Seaver, right, in the Baseball Hall of Fame, former Marine from Fresno, California. And so he'd give up a home run. He'd get the new ball, go to the back of the mound, and he'd be pissed, you could tell. And he's rubbing the new ball up. And then he would take this huge breath. And he'd blow it out. And I watched him do this a number of times. And then one day I was standing there, and I said, hey, Tom, can I ask you a question? And he said, yeah. And I said, when you go to the back of the mound, if you give up a home run and you do that thing where you take a deep breath, I said, what is that? He says, well, let me tell you, I've had bad experiences where I don't get that shit out of my head. And then I get up on the mound and I give up another one, I hurt my team. So I know if I'm going to be the best version of me, I've got to get rid of that. And one of the things I learned was it helps to physically for me to blow it out of my body. He said, so I'm getting rid of it, and when I blow it out of my body, that breath you see, that's what I'm doing. And when I turn around, it's out of my head. He said, and you know, it really works.
This is delving deep into a whole different angle. But for a while there, I was reading books by Dan Millman about the Way of the Peaceful Warrior series, and it's really about kind of making peace with yourself. And that speaks directly to like the Japanese kind of enlightenment idea of Satori, which is really just getting out of your head. Just not thinking about what's going to happen later, not thinking about what just happened or the mistake that you made, and focusing entirely on what's happening right now. And sports, and I would argue training in the military, are both situations where you really do experience enlightenment in that regard. You know, when you're doing movement under fire drills, when you're doing McMap training, you know, you're grappling with your friends, when you're playing football, you're experiencing the Satori. And, you know, the way they explain it, Dan Millman explains it in the book, is if I threw a baseball at you, from the second or the instant the baseball left my hand to the instant that the baseball either gets caught by you or hits the ground or hits you in the face, you exist only in that split second of staring at that baseball flying at your face. You're not worried about your electric bill. You're not worried about that girl you asked out last Tuesday. You are worried only about right now and that baseball heading for your face. And that's enlightenment, is not worrying about all the rest of that shit. But that's really kind of what he's speaking to there, too. It's a form of meditation to get you to what a lot of people really do consider to be the mountaintop. And that's just being right with yourself, getting out of your head. You know, so I think you're dead set, you're nailing it. You're right on.
But again, I call that like, because when I think of meditation, I think of Rafiki and the Lion King. And I know that's me. Right, and that's...
I think that's common, though. I mean,
right?
Here we go. I read all these stupid books, but that's still what I think, too, you know?
Right, so we're Marines. Like, if the gunny walks out and says, Hollings, what are you doing? And you say, I'm meditating, gunny. And he's like, oh, come here, sunshine. I got something for you to do. But if you looked at him and said, hey, Hollings, what are you doing? I'm doing GBMFR.
Getting right in my head, man.
Right? And he'd say, you keep doing that, right? Because let me tell you...
It's funny you say that. I know a fighter pilot named Justin Lee. He's an F-35 pilot who's got, I mean, hundreds of hours in the F-16 combat hours, but now he trains F-35 pilots. And he meditates every day. You know, he swears by it. He says it's an important part of his approach to warfare.
I show a picture of LeBron James and a picture of Michael Jordan meditating. LeBron James during the game, right? Like I said, look, I don't, and I in the presentation I say, I don't know if you know who these guys are, but they make a lot of money. and they tend to do really good under high pressure, condensed time, right, situations. What does that sound like? Sounds like the world that you live in. Now, if they'll do it, and if 90% of the Fortune 100 CEOs do it, okay, do you think that you might consider it? And then I tell the Tom Seaver story. And I said, so I'm not talking about Rafiki and the Lion King. There's ways that you can do this when you're on the move, like Tom Seaver did in the middle of the baseball game. And I said, let me tell you, and I do that now, and it helps me. I literally stop what I'm doing, right, when somebody pisses me the fuck off in Home Depot, and you know how when they tell you to fuck off but they don't say it?
Yeah.
And then your brain says, kill this motherfucker, right? And you want to. And you're looking at their Adam's apple going, if I could just get my fingers around that Adam's apple, I'll yank that son of a bitch out, and they're going to have a nasty cleanup here on aisle 43, but I'm going to feel better about life. And so you know you're not supposed to do that because you're not going to be able to spend Christmas with your daughter volunteering. So how do you do it? Right? You stop. You take a deep breath. Turn your back to it. Hold it for a second. And when you blow it out, you blow physically. It's gone from my body. And so to me, I'll complete one of the many points that I started here. This is one of the parts of post-traumatic winning. And then the point I make after that is, let me talk about us as patients. We fucking suck as patients, right? We've got to be better custodians of our own health, to include our mental health. And it starts with, and then I talk about medication. And then I talk about, if you go to a therapist that isn't giving you what you need, fire that motherfucker. Go talk to somebody and say, hey, look, he or she is not helping me. I need somebody that will help me.
And that's again, I want to emphasize again, these guys are not your commanding officers. No. You know, you do not need to say, all right, good to go. You know, I can't tell you, but going into every one of my surgeries, I didn't ask a single question. I just said, all right, aye, sir. You know, good to go, sir. Yes, ma'am. Got it. You know, and in hindsight, I really do regret that. At the time, it was my mindset, you know. When I got out of the Marine Corps and I had one surgery post-Marine Corps, I'll never forget going through, like, all the same, you know, hurdles that you jump through going in for a knee surgery. But the approach that the people had was very different to me. They kept asking me if I understood, which had never happened to me before because I didn't think anyone had ever given a shit if I understood prior to that. You know, and I was like, wait a minute. Are you saying that I could walk out of here right now? I thought I was here under orders, you know. But that's a funny example of something that really does matter, though, because if you're going, it's already difficult enough to finally bite the bullet and go to the doctor to talk about getting treatment, getting medication, talking to a therapist. It is hard, it's embarrassing, and it's scary until you get there. It's just like going to the gym. The lead up seems awful, and then you get there and it's not so bad, right? But when you get there, you have to be able to be honest, and you can't be honest at parade rest. You know, you have to recognize that, yeah, this person is a subject matter expert. Yeah, maybe 3 weeks ago, or if you're still in, maybe they are a commander to your sergeant. But at the end of the day, the end user here is you.
Yeah. Your health is your business. And again, military courtesy is what you owe them. You know, drinking.
But honesty is what you owe yourself.
Exactly. And there's a balance in that. But I will tell you this, you got to teach that because, you know, like all of us, you go in there initially when you're a novice and you're like, okay. Well, they told me to do this. And there may be a time and a place for some of that. But if you're not comfortable with it, it's your, you know, you signed the contract to commit your life to the nation. Right, and what you deserve back from that is the quality health care, both physical and mental, that you deserve. And so, to me, that's a no brainer. But you got to teach that, and it's one of the when I started talking about it, it was relatively a short segment. Now it's one of the longer segments I do in post traumatic winning.
That makes sense, honestly, because it's one of the bigger challenges it's one of the bigger hurdles between, I think, your average person who's having a hard time and the steps that they need to take to get right with themselves, right? That hurdle of being able to be honest with your caregivers, with your medical caregivers, is huge, you know? Because, I want to emphasize this one more time, I know Mac has said it 1,000 times, pills are not the answer. Pills can absolutely benefit your effort. There are medications that can help you. There are medications that might hurt your effort, that might hinder your effort if they're the wrong ones. But that's the reason why you've got to be honest with your doctor. It is, to a certain extent, when it comes to anti-anxiety and anti-depression medications, a bit of guess and check. It is very much, I'd like you to try this medication for 6 weeks, and let's see what that does for you. And then you're going to come back in 6 weeks, and you need to follow up. If you just take the bottle of pills, walk out, and just keep taking them without ever giving it an after-action report, there's no guarantee that it's going to do any good for you. You've got to constantly be reevaluating your approach to mental health if you want to get better. Just like anything, if you want to win a war, you've got to keep reevaluating what's been working and what hasn't been working to make sure that you're successful moving forward. If you want to win a war with mental health, you got to do the same thing.
You know, one of the dudes that listens to this show, his name's Chris Cox, former Marine, lives up in Massachusetts. He's lost over 250 pounds.
That's incredible.
Got out of the Marine Corps and weight got up to 500 pounds. He just sent me pictures last Friday. Thursday and Friday, he went skiing.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome.
Right. And he didn't do any, like, bypass surgery or stomach, surgery or anything like that. It's just old-fashioned. And his goal is to pass the Marine Corps PFT that he said he's gonna start training for pretty soon here.
You know, I love that, because I'll admit, when I work out, I still keep the Marine Corps PFT in mind all the time. CFT, not so much, because it was pretty new when I left. But I'm still, every time I touch a pull-up bar, even if it's the very tail end of my workout and I am exhausted, you will not see me touch a pull-up bar and get fewer than 3 pull-ups. Ever.
The it just doesn't go like that. But I mean, how cool is that? And he credits, and I'm going to tell you something. Let me ask you a question. How much has your life changed in terms of your happy index since you've had a kid?
That's hard. It's hard to calculate. In all honesty, my kid is the only thing in my life that has ever exceeded my happiness expectations. You know, you think about when you're a kid graduating high school and being a grown-up. And then you think about when you're in the Marine Corps, you go, oh, well, when I'm out of the Marine Corps. And when you're in college, you say, oh, once I graduate. There are all these false finish lines in your life where you think things will change, and they don't really. You feel the same the next day. My kid is the only thing that blew even my expectations out of the water. She's my reason for getting up in the morning. So I couldn't even tell you it's that incalculable. That's how much my happiness levels have changed with her. But that's also the reason why I've had to engage with my demons directly instead of ignoring them like I had before I had a kid. So in a weird way, you know, as you guys know, I've talked about this before, I started going and speaking to a counselor after becoming a dad. It's not because my happiness levels were lower. It's because it became that much more important for me to get my shit together, you know?
And let me tell you, and that number is only going to go higher as you go follow through and do these things with her, go volunteer with you, and you see her come to you and say the same things that all kids have said. I remember the first time that I took my sons to a Special Olympics event. I was director of sports for Special Olympics in North Dakota for the state. And we went to the state soccer tournament. I took my sons. And the conversation, they'd never been around Special Olympics in their lives. The conversations that we had on the way home, unbelievable. You know, well, Dad, I don't understand. You know, could that happen to any kid? Well, yeah, it's a genetic disorder, and that's how it's transmitted, and blah, blah, blah. Well, but what about so-and-so? She's not mentally retarded, right? And I said, no, she is. No, Dad, no, not her. Her name's Chrissy. She's from Minot. She plays soccer, right? And I'm like, no, she is. No, Dad, are you sure you're thinking of the same? Yes, the girl, right? She did this. Yes. She's an athlete? Yes, she is. And you want to know what my kids learned? Just to treat everybody like you would want to be treated. That's what my kids learned out of all this. And throughout
so much about parenting sounds like a cliche until you're in the foxhole. And it rings so true to me that it feels revelatory.
Right. When you see them do it, so we go to, and I happen to be home, and we, and Patrick's in high school, we go to his report card night in high school. And so where they have, and it's open house, right? And you go inside. So I can't remember which teacher said, hey, could I tell you about your son? You know, always nervous, right? your son has a gift with special needs people, you know, boys and girls here at the school. He walks into that cafeteria, and the first thing he does is he yells at his special needs friends that are sitting at a table, like, what's up, right? And then he and his friends, they go get their lunch, and they go over and they sit at this table with everybody, and they hang out. And I said, well, you know, he learned that at Special Olympics. And he said, they see him, and they throw a fit, man. And I said, no. And you know what it is, Alex? It's those experiences that, again, you can lecture them till you're blue in the face. But if you want them to understand Christmas, go volunteer. And again, unless you've raised a complete idiot, right, they will not be able to help but ask the question of, hey, Dad, will they get any more presents tonight?
You know, and that also allows me to address another concern that I've had. I started having this worry with my nephew, not even with my daughter. You know, my older brother works in racing. He runs one of the biggest racetracks in the country, so he's doing pretty well for himself. So his kid just thinks, you know, having a Dodge Hellcat and a Dodge Viper and a Porsche in the garage is normal, you know? the same way my daughter absolutely thinks, to a much lesser extent, we make a great deal less money, but, you know, that having two big screen TVs in the basement so mom and dad can play video games together is normal, you know? Whereas I grew up very differently, you know? And I worry that my daughter won't have that appreciation for what she has, that I was lucky enough to develop by happenstance because my parents didn't have any money until I was in high school, you know? So by the time my parents started making a pretty good living, I was like, holy crap, we have two cars? This is awesome. My daughter, on the other hand, this stuff is all normal to her. And I've been struggling with the idea of trying to impart to her that she's fortunate, you know, that we really won the lottery here in a lot of ways. And, yeah, I do work my ass off for the things that we have. But I would argue that my professional successes have been just as informed by luck, by being in the right place at the right time, as anything else. You know, we're really lucky, but for the grace of God, go I, you know, when you see people in tougher positions. And I want her to know that. And I think that you're right, man. I think that volunteering is the way that I can make sure that she understands that she got a really lucky hand dealt to her when she was born. That doesn't mean she'll live a life devoid of challenges. But it means that she's starting from a much better position than she could have. And I want her to know that so that she can better appreciate the ways that she can help other people, you know?
And that's
maybe not just in the holiday season like Dad. Maybe she'll be an actual good person and help people the rest of the year too.
No, but again, it's the key to raising good people and who have the skills to cope with life. And that's how this whole conversation.
And what does that do? Started. That informs all the problems we're having right now. Right. That informs our political process. Right. That informs our interactions on social media. That informs how horrible pop culture has become. All of that really boils down to if you've got good coping mechanisms and we treat each other
with
respect. I always say everybody should behave in a way that if everybody acted like you, society would work out all right. You know,
no, General Mattis was talking about that last week at the Washington Post has done. I want to ask you about this, but the Washington Post does this thing called the Washington Post Live, in their effort to be a multimedia organization, right? So, he said that. He said, look, one of the things that's changed in this country is, you know, when we compete against each other in an election, right? Elections are ugly, mean things. And what we have to get back to is once the election's over, we put that stuff aside and we work together for the greater good of the nation until the next election. He said, now it's a constant election. There is no differential and there is no working together and the nation can't be successful like that.
So and what ends up happening? We end up back with continuing resolution spending for the 11th year, not in a row. I think there was one gap year there in the middle. Because everybody's too worried about the political game and the ongoing campaign that never ends. It's even a big deal for our lawmakers. They're not doing it because they want to more often than not. They are continually campaigning because they have to keep their job.
Well, I had a senator tell me, he was a senator from the state of North Dakota. He said, look, compromise is the lubricant of democracy. And now, if you compromise, the only thing that you assure yourself of is the fact that you'll have a contestant in your own party's primary in the next election, and you're going to be painted as a sellout. That's where we're at today.
It's true.
And it's the 24-hour news cycle, and the power and the money that exists on both extremes of the spectrum, coupled with two news organizations that trumpet that shit all day long. And that's what you deal with as a politician.
And I would argue to a certain extent the classic flip-flopper insult also has a role to play in this, because I would absolutely expect and even demand that my politicians change their opinion on things when presented new information. You know, if you believe that smoking wasn't bad for you, and then someone handed you a scientifically peer-reviewed and backed report that showed that smoking was bad for you, you read it, you understood it, you appreciated it, you should walk out of that room going, oh shit, man, I guess smoking's bad for you. That is not a reason not to elect someone. That is, in my opinion, a reason to elect someone. Right. I'm not trying to elect you at 19 when you wrote that thing on Twitter. I'm trying to elect you today. You know? And this is, again, it all comes back to our ability to engage with one another, which really speaks to our ability to engage with ourselves, right? We don't have coping mechanisms to deal with our own problems. We project them onto others. Then we vilify them and pretend they're not human beings. And we have yet another – it looks like we're heading into another election season where it's going to be a question of who seems less worse to you.
And again, the whole world is shaped by this election cycle too. And I was talking about Lindsey Graham.
Other countries' foreign policies are based entirely around our election cycle.
Well, and Lindsey Graham in Afghanistan today saying that we're going to draw down 4,000 troops. Now, what's significant about that? Well, you could. Now, my question was, why is this a conditions-based event, or
is this a PR move?
What do we know that's going to happen in 11 months? Oh, we're going to have another election.
And this is the reason why, I mean, this is where we're going down some rabbit holes here, but this is one of the biggest disadvantages.
Right? Is this an election year stunt, right? Choreographed, right? What does CENTCOM have to say about this? Does CENTCOM support this? Does the Pentagon and the Secretary of Defense support this? Is this, in fact, a part of the conditions-based strategy to get this thing to a new place? Or, again, is it much like President Obama did? Is it delivering on a campaign's promise in spite of the implications of it?
Exactly. And those are my concerns. And the problem with this type of thing is that America tends to govern via headline.
Yeah.
If all you get are the headlines, you know, last week, the Afghanistan papers saying that, you know, everything's bad in Afghanistan. This week, we're announcing a withdrawal of 4,000 troops from Afghanistan. When you look at just those headlines in a vacuum, there are some people, and this was the intent behind it, there are some people who will absolutely read that as Donald Trump saw that the American people were angry that we still had troops in Afghanistan, so we pulled the troops out of Afghanistan. The problem is, and we do this sort of thing a lot. I don't want to sound like I'm just beating up on Donald Trump. We do this sort of thing, just like you said with Obama, politics by headline. We've been doing it for decades. And the real issue that we run into here, it's just like pulling troops out of Syria. Everybody said we want to get rid of these forever wars, and then Donald Trump said, okay, I'm going to pull troops out of Syria. Then people who were, you know, pretty well learned in what was going on in Syria said, hey, the way we're going about this is wrong. The way we're doing this is going to cause bigger problems. And the response from Donald Trump and his supporters was, well, what am I supposed to do? I can either keep guys in Syria or I can take them out of Syria. Those are the only two options. When the truth is, there is a vast variety of options. There are a million ways to draw troops down in Afghanistan. There are a million ways to reduce troops in Syria. They don't all happen overnight.
And, oh, by the way, they ought to be linked to some kind of strategy that's in our national interest.
Exactly.
And you ought to be able to
a foreign policy mistake overnight.
And, yeah.
So if it was a foreign policy mistake for us to get into Afghanistan, I buy it. Sure. Here's the issue, though. We already made that mistake. You can't just go take back pull the troops out. You know, this is what you have to do is you need to address the world as it is, not as it should have been if we hadn't made that mistake. I'm not saying that this is what we're doing, to be honest with you. I do not know all the nuts and bolts of the 4,000 troop Afghanistan withdrawal that they're talking about. But my concerns are that it's a political decision and not a strategic decision, and that is not in our best interest as a nation.
Lindsey Graham said it's a conditions-based with drawdown.
Which, you know what, if it is conditions-based and the conditions are logical ones, hey, I'm for it.
Just for the record, Lindsey Graham was extremely critical of the president's actions in Syria, right? So it's significant that he would be over there, and he was kind of the one that would, you know, the choreography of this is that he's kind of announcing it to the world in advance of the president, you know, supposedly going to announce it next week, which is kind of an interesting choreography. But
you know how these things go, though, because, I mean, like, didn't Huckabee announce last week that he's in charge of Trump's 2024 campaign because they're going to pretend that this administration didn't count because the Democrats cheated or something? And I don't buy when people announce that there's going to be an announcement. I'm going to wait until there's an announcement, and then I'll read about that. I hate these might stories, you know. But in this case with Lindsey Graham, I think that there's a very high likelihood that this is an intentional and a strategic announcement he's making. They're gauging American responses to it so that they can counter prominent arguments against it when they go with the full unveiling, which is a logical approach, honestly, to public affairs.
Let me ask you, I want to talk about three things before you leave me today. one is the Afghanistan papers. For anybody who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, the fact that our elected officials don't exactly speak about the wars with great candor is not a surprise to anybody. All right. So I'm curious your reaction to the Washington Post's Afghanistan papers, if you will.
I got to be honest. When they first came out, I did not talk a lot about it because I was like, I want to read more into it because I don't really understand what's so revelatory about this. And then after reading some more into it, I'm inclined to agree with James Madison, say that this doesn't seem as revelatory as the press has treated it. Among those of us who have been talking about the war in Afghanistan throughout a fair portion of it, I don't think that there were a lot of surprises in here. You know, these interviews were based on hindsight interviews from commanders that were no longer in theater, a lot of times no longer in service. So we're talking hindsight interviews from senior officials. I'm not in any way disagreeing that Afghanistan has been a mess. I am in a way, though, disagreeing that it's such a surprise that Afghanistan has been a mess. I feel as though a lot of us for a long time have understood that Afghanistan has been a mess, but the American people, by and large, were kind of leaning on this idea of an all-knowing government where, sure, I don't get it, and sure, that guy on TV doesn't seem like he gets it, but somewhere somebody gets it. You know, and I think that maybe what this Washington Post story has really done is kind of do away with that curtain between Oz and the American people to a certain extent. But to me, it was no surprise that we didn't know what our end game was in Afghanistan. To me, it comes as no surprise that we had a criminally ignorant understanding of Afghani culture going in. To me, it's no surprise that leaders leaving Afghanistan felt as though they were set up for failure because they weren't given clear objectives to accomplish. All of this stuff is stuff that we heard about in real time, you know?
Okay, here's my question, and that is this. When we decided that we would remain in Afghanistan and create something that the earth has never seen on that piece of ground, which was a...
And I would fault George Bush for that, yeah.
Well, Tommy Franks was CENTCOM. Phase 4 was not articulated for him. What is the end state of all of this? And he
exactly. And
he went forward. So to me, the question is, if that was not articulated to you, why didn't you throw a fit? And why didn't you say, I cannot do this?
And so, I would argue that, and that's important. I'm not saying that there weren't a litany of failures here. Just the only part of it to me is that I think that we were already well aware of many of these failures. I think that the nation didn't want to engage with them.
They hadn't occurred at that point. So you're at a decision like, well, should we expand the ground war in Afghanistan? should we get in the business of nation building, if you will? And the answer to that, well, you know, look, unlike what we've done in other parts of the world, they have never existed as a nation, right? Ever. So are we willing to stay here for 150 years?
And to be honest with you, and what we're looking at is it's very similar to the corporate dissolution of responsibility structure. The idea being, you know, when corporate conglomerates do things that are evil, it's easy to say a corporation is evil. But there's, you know, 4 million individual people that are, for all we know, good people that are actually moving the cogs of the evil corporation, right? We do the same thing with the government. Responsibility is so diluted through command changeovers, through a dissemination of responsibility and authority all throughout the chain of command, that there are no individuals to be held accountable at the end of the day when it comes to huge policy failures like this. So instead, what you end up with is something like the Afghanistan papers, which is a whole bunch of people in hindsight saying, oh, yeah, this stuff was all screwed up, but it wasn't me. The part that I did was good. I was handed a losing hand, and I played it the best that I could.
But what,
every person's
okay, so
story is here, that I played the hand I was dealt. The problem is that there's no dealer actually dealing this. It's actually lots and lots of people each dealing a portion of a card of these hands. And then what happens is we have commanders and we have politicians that have, as far as they see it, a finite amount of time to do a good job. And ultimately, their job security is reliant upon them doing a good job. So when it comes time for them to tell the American people whether or not they did a good job, we are not going to find commanders. We are not going to find politicians that are going to come out and say, guys, I really screwed the pooch on this. Nobody, as far as they're concerned, is the one that screwed the pooch.
So, no,
there's a snowball.
There's a couple of great historical examples that I would offer you as when military guys become politicians and won't tell the truth.
No, I agree with you there. I'm not saying
one is the German army and their officers.
We're not talking about military guys that went to the press. They didn't go talk to the Washington Post.
No.
They were talking.
No. I'm talking about military guys who won't do the right thing. And so to me, so the German general officers, right, they at no point took on Hitler, and they all made decisions that, well, I'll stay in this.
But you're making a good analogy here. That is a good example.
Okay, let me give you another one.
Responsibility is so dissolved.
Vietnam is another one.
Vietnam's another good comparison here. This is the problem, is that we haven't solved these problems.
Why?
We can be angry that human nature is as human nature is, but that's not a pragmatic approach to solving this. That's just being angry, right? People aren't going to change. Humanity, we're not going to genetically change the way that we approach blame and responsibility. We're not going to say, take food out of my family's mouths. We're not going to do it.
Yeah, but
we need to work on having a system that doesn't allow for these macro policy failures.
But systems are composed of what? People of integrity who won't do those things.
Integrity is not essential for a system to function. It benefits a system, but it is not essential for a system to function. There are plenty of systems that operate with the understanding that the people who participate in the system are dishonest. The idea is that humans are ultimately self-serving. That is the premise behind capitalism. The idea behind
But when you raise your oath, when you raise your hand to take an oath,
you should be better than that. You're still worried about your kids.
But
man.
If you won't look, but at that, but the, at the level of people that we're talking about, their kids aren't going hungry, right?
But this is what. But you know as well as I do that as your lot in life improves, your worries, your anxieties don't diminish, right? So if you're the commander of CENTCOM, if you're the Secretary of Defense, if you're the President of the United States of America, you're not no longer worried about your own success because you're already successful. If anything, you're just as worried as you were when you were poor. Granted, a lot of these guys were never poor when it comes to politics. But how much money is in your bank account is not going to dissuade you from trying to portray yourself in a positive light, especially because in your head, you're not the bad guy. It's important, again, to remember that we are talking about people who are people, who were doing their best often, who, and even when they weren't doing their best, have convinced themselves that they did, right? So when you say the Afghanistan papers we tend to think of it as it's like this thing vilifying a group of people, a small group. In reality, we're talking about thousands of individuals that each played a very small role, that those small roles collectively created huge problems. But this isn't a blame game. We can't solve this by finding the right guy to hang. The only way we can solve this is by establishing systems that understand that people are ultimately going to, number one, justify their own behavior, and number two, look out for themselves. When you have a guy who genuinely believes that he didn't do anything wrong, even when he sees that the result of his efforts turned out bad, he's going to look for reasons. A lot of these people are going to say that the hand that I was dealt was unfair, which is true. A lot of these people will say that the policies wouldn't work, which is true. I do not think that we can blame that individual for not being the whistleblower that blew the whistle on Afghanistan when the entirety of this conflict has been full of stories, full of people talking about how screwed up this conflict has been. It's not a revelation. It's just that all of a sudden now Americans can look at one collection of all the times we said it was screwed up. I think that this is, and I know this always makes me the bad guy, I think that this is exemplary of a failure on the American people's part to hold our lawmakers accountable.
I don't know. Look, politicians lie. That's what they do. There's only one group that swears an oath to the nation that is, whose business ought to be to tell the truth.
Is lying. If you were the commander in theater, let's say you landed in Afghanistan, you're the commander in theater. You're going to do your best with the cards that you're dealt to meet the objectives that you're given, because the metrics for success that you're given are outlined in a certain way, and you're going to work to fulfill those metrics for success. You're not necessarily worried about the macro scope 50 years from now.
No. But Alex, look, I'll use Iraq as an example. Nobody said we didn't have. Nobody came home and said we don't have enough people there. We've got to. Why? Because they saw what Shinseki got shoved out the door by Rumsfeld. Okay. That has to change. We've redone Vietnam. And,
no, you're right.
And what happened during Desert...
Blame doesn't change anything.
It has to start with that. You have to assign blame. There's
in the city square does not solve our problems going forward. It makes you feel better about our problems behind us.
I don't even know what that means, but whatever.
Well, then I'll explain it.
Who's CENTCOM, who doesn't have phase four articulated for him in either Iraq or Afghanistan, right?
This is what I'm saying. How do you change that lesson, when you're that commander?
The lesson of Vietnam is, right, you can't do that.
You argue that they should come back and talk about it with the Washington Post.
Well, my argument is...
going to manifest change.
My argument is...
Lots of people did that.
No, not before the fact. They did it after the fact.
Well, yeah, everybody does it after the fact because they have kids to pay or kids to feed.
No, but at that rank, they're not going to go hungry, man.
But that's what I'm saying is you act as though once you reach a certain point in success, you don't care about your career anymore. You don't care about your livelihood.
You don't care about your legacy. Okay, so you become a politician and you're willing to lie and violate the oath that
you
take. Because what you're telling me is that these guys lie and they don't tell the truth.
Lance corporals
are out there fucking dying. And they don't have to perform with the same moral courage that a Lance corporal has to perform. And I think that's bullshit.
No, I disagree with that too, because a sergeant filling out his FITREP also isn't going to write about his failures. A sergeant filling out his FITREP is going to write about his successes, because he's worried about his livelihood, because he's worried about his career. This is the way progression works. This is the way career advancement works. This isn't new. This is intrinsic to our military system. So if we want things to be different, we need to change the system. Because people aren't going to be different because they promise to be. People are going to look out for themselves, and they're going to look out for their families. And more often than not, they're not going to see themselves as the villain that you paint them as, because their role in this greater dilemma was significantly smaller than we want to characterize it as, because there's 8,000 people that are guilty of this charade.
But only one's in charge.
But that's what I'm saying. There are 8,000 people that are or have been in charge of various aspects of the conflict.
I don't disagree that there are people that should be held more acutely responsible than others, and I don't disagree.
There are, certainly, I would agree.
I don't disagree that.
But there
that
is no one or two people that you can hang this on.
No,
really
no, no, no. What I'm
know?
Saying is that you, if you're in that position, and you're mm-hmm. being and you're watching them tell lies to the American people, you don't have an obligation to tell the truth.
You know,
and if you're telling me no, if you're telling me no,
every Marine unit that deploys when I was deployed to Africa,
if you're telling me no, Alex, that means the whole system's a fucking lie.
Let me ask you this: when I was deployed to Africa for Shared Accord in 2010, I distinctly remember coming home and looking at the news stories run by a Marine Corps PAO about what we were doing out there, and going, "Oh, that's bullshit." I distinctly remember that. Because the Marine Corps, just like every branch of the military, just like every organization, is worried about public relations. And the Marine Corps painted the rosiest picture to a pretty stupid and debacle-filled deployment that they possibly could. And they talked about how rad we were. And it made us look really good, but it was also full of shit. I, as a sergeant of Marines who played my role on that deployment, did not feel it was my responsibility to take PAO to task, call the Washington Post, and say, oh, no, actually, this deployment was all screwed up. My job was to do my job, and I did my job. And I know that when you think of it from that, you go, oh, well, you're just a platoon sergeant. There's plenty of layers. That's exactly what every person involved in this felt like. They go, oh, well, I was just a blankety blank, one of 8,000 other blankety blanks, all just doing our best. And that's the reality of the real world, is that not everything is black and white. A lot of times things tend to come in shades of gray. And when you're handed a shit sandwich, you do your best with that shit sandwich. And when it comes time for you to write your fit rep, when it comes time for your end of tour awards, you're going to give a guy a list of bullet points of all the rad shit that you did. You are not going to say, man, I really screwed the pooch on this. And in your mind, for this to work, people would have to say, I was the point of failure. Because after the fact,
well, again,
saying,
I don't
I did
look.
This 3 years ago, but it's their fault because they never gave me, you know, they kept moving the field, the goalposts on me.
When
it makes you sound like a failure. It doesn't make them sound like a
When you're in
bad.
A position to say yes or no to events, not one of the person that's given orders. When you're in a position to say yes or no to events,
you have a responsibility.
You have a responsibility that others don't. Right?
I agree.
That others don't. And I think that
But I don't think that we should leverage the future of our country on assuming that you are always going to make the right call.
So then
we need to have a system that allows for mistakes, and we need to have a system that allows for corrections. You know, and because here's the real truth of the matter. At any point leading up to the current president, whatever
Wait a minute,
president
a system that
plays,
allows for mistakes and corrections. So
just like
if
we were
if
before,
if we hold on if we
data,
walk
man.
If we walk the dog on that, right? A system that allows for mistakes. So it has to be based on the truth though, right? And so
well, that's where these Afghanistan papers came from. These papers came from a DOD effort.
Hold on. So how do you get to the truth? How do you do the right thing when you got somebody like Don Rumsfeld who doesn't want to hear what the fuck you have to say? And so when we decide what we're going to endeavor to create something that's never been created in Afghanistan, and your military judgment says, we're going to be here for 100 years. But the American people get told, well, we're going to be here for like 3 years.
Well,
and you know it's bullshit, so how does the system work if you don't stand up and speak the truth? And again, on every confirmation you hear,
you're yelling and screaming about people doing the thing that they literally exactly did. The Afghanistan papers were all purged from the Office of the Inspector General for Reconstruction of Afghanistan. These were after-action reports. This was a DOD effort to figure out what the hell was wrong with Afghanistan and try to make changes, not just to fix Afghanistan, but to fix future conflicts. That's where these all come from. The Washington Post didn't collect each of these interviews themselves. The DOD did, as a part of that effort. Granted, the DOD is not without blame here. The DOD is to blame here. They are literally responsible. But what I'm saying is the system was too slow. The system did a bad job, but the system needs to change to fix this. hanging someone doesn't fix this.
But the system is people, Alex. If you hide people, if you put people in the system that won't tell the truth at critical moments in our history, then you have what you have. And
I would recommend that you establish a recruiting process ensures dishonesty is weeded out.
No system can withstand shit people who don't have the moral courage, right, to stand up and tell the truth.
But no system can exist in a vacuum of shit people. 10% of everybody sucks, bare minimum. I mean, we said that all the time in the Marine Corps. 10% of you guys shouldn't even be here. You know? That doesn't change in the government. That doesn't change at high levels of leadership. You're always going to have leadership failures. There's always going to be shitty people in the system. The secret, yes, hold those shitty people accountable. But at the end of the day, the threat of being held accountable is only enough to make you do so much. We cannot have a black and white system. We have to have a system that recognizes failures, which this was too slow in doing, but there was a system in place with that intent, which was
It was too slow. People knew it, but there isn't one. That's my point.
We've known Afghanistan has been a clusterfuck for at least 10 years now. I mean, I could argue, 19, but for at least 10 years now, we've known that Afghanistan is an absolute clusterfuck.
Well, here's the disconnect. If you want to try to do this in 5 years, it can't happen. You should never even go down that road. So the disconnect is thinking as a nation that we're going to create something that's never existed on the planet in a very short period of time, and we're going to bend these cultures to this different way of living. We're going to create all the infrastructure and the support infrastructure for it, and then we're going to leave. We're going to do that in 5 years. It's stupid.
But we as voters didn't hold our lawmakers accountable, who are the ones that established this policy.
Well, again,
don't. Even now we're talking about who was the Pentagon.
I got that, but the problem, this is my problem. The people, the military people, who have sworn an oath, right? It's their responsibility to look at the American people and tell them the truth. We can't get there.
But every time a military leader tries to do that, it immediately gets politicized. James Mattis is a good example of a guy who tries not to jump too deep into politics, and he gets vilified for trying not to jump too deep into politics. As soon as you, as a military person, come out and say anything that could potentially harm a politician, you are immediately a politician. Let's look at the way that this entire impeachment proceeding has been handled.
If you're a conservative, I don't want to talk about anybody
in a uniform who's got an anti-Trump stance is all of a sudden a bad service.
Let me tell you why I don't want to talk about impeachment. Because to me, there's an element when you're in uniform and you have sworn an oath, right? You've sworn an oath as an officer not to execute anybody.
You a good American and service member. Another guy will argue makes you a bad American and service member. Is the point I'm trying to make?
At the highest levels on issues of national policy, if we don't have people that will tell the truth, right, then we should not do any of the shit we tried to do, because all we're doing is we're killing hundreds of thousands of people, right. And our system, as you're talking about, that's populated with people that will not right now stand up and look at the American people and say, look, I want everybody to know this. Okay? This is hard work. And I would say this is going to take 50 to 60 years, probably closer to 100, to do this. And we're going to be here for a long time. And everybody needs to understand that.
If someone came home and said that, they'd be fired.
Then that's fine. That's fine. But the debate need that if that's the truth.
But
if
things like that have happened and things didn't change is the point that I'm
making. Who came home and said that? Nobody.
There has been a number of leaders who have spoken out against the president. I mean, you could make the argument that James Mattis didn't become the commandant of the Marine Corps because he wasn't politically popular with the Obama administration. If you do not play ball with the administration, you are not going to.
That's
stay
fine then.
In
don't
your
but
of
don't
power.
You think given
and then
your
guess what changes? Nothing.
But don't you think that's your moral obligation is to do that?
I think that you could make that argument, sure, but I also think that when you do that, people will immediately portray you as a person who has a political axe to grind against whoever the
sitting president
is.
Well, you know what? Again, that would be Fox and CNN, and I'm not. That would, I don't. I don't really care about them.
A fair portion of America.
But if the leaders, if the leaders that lead our military won't tell the truth, politicians never tell the truth, then what hope is there for the nation to get involved in anything outside of our borders and have there be a good outcome except by random chance?
Now, I agree with you. So then my question is, what can we as the American people do, right? We as the American people cannot storm the Pentagon and find someone to blame and make them kneel on rice, right? We as the American people can, however, in our elections, vote for congressmen that ask hard questions. We can vote for senators that ask hard questions. We can vote for presidents that will hopefully have policies that are more in keeping with what we think. The problem is that the president, which is the only voting most Americans give a shit about, is not enough to change things like this. Congress needs to change things like this. The day-to-day operations of our government need to change things like this. The president cannot sign an executive order that fixes Afghanistan. So the presidential politics that Americans are so enamored with are not how we solve problems like Afghanistan. Knowing who your congressman is how we start to solve problems like Afghanistan. And until Americans are willing to find out who their congressman is and whether or not they're doing things that they support, until they start voting congressmen out when they don't do things that we support, we're going to continue to see things like Afghanistan. We're going to continue to see continuing resolution spending. We're going to continue to see a government that isn't looking out for our best interests. They're looking out for their next campaign. Until we start actually voting, the people that we vote into office have no incentive to do anything that we want them to do. It's as simple as that. So we as Americans, how do we fix this? How do we manage the Afghanistan papers? Take it, read it, or read a summation of it if you're real busy. Be informed by it. Google who your representatives are and what their voting records are. Find out what their position is on it moving forward. Support politicians that can actually manifest change instead of just going, oh, my God, I can't believe we've had the same congressman for 92 years. Yeah, I've never voted. That's how you solve problems like this.
And you're asking politicians to tell the truth.
No, I'm asking Americans to hold politicians accountable. Instead of saying, well, let's just hold the Pentagon accountable because we know politicians won't tell the truth, let's vote some of these guys out of office. Let's put politicians in office that will hold the Pentagon accountable. Instead of mandating that the Pentagon just mimics their talking points for the sake of the next election, which is what we've gotten, what we continue to get for a long time now.
I don't think that politicians will be anything other than what politicians have always been throughout history, which is liars.
Well, with that assessment, if we can't elect a single politician that will benefit the country, then our form of government doesn't work.
No, I mean,
our form of government theoretically can work. We just need to actually
vote. It works. It works, but I mean, you're asking politicians who have one agenda, and that is to, you know, to be reelected, you know, asking them to perform to some extent.
And you know, and when you're a three-star general, you've got an agenda too.
Well, and to me, that's what can be fixed and needs to be fixed, because if you look at the equation, there's only one group of people that is capable of telling the truth, and when they become politicians. And which is what you're describing to me.
I would make the same argument, though, about being a general as I would about being the president, which is if you want to be a general or a president, you're probably a self-serving asshole.
All right, well, and you know what? And I think that, no, I mean, sadly, that's...
I'm not saying that every general out there is a bad guy. The same way I'm sure that there are good politicians out there, I just haven't Googled yet.
No, but they're conformist, right? And they've ridden to the top of the corporation.
They're operating within a world that is a dog-eat-dog world. Everything about politics is about assigning blame, and if you're not careful, you will be the one that the blame is assigned to. So everybody's primarily concerned with covering their six the minute that you get to that level, you know? And don't get me wrong, to a certain extent, it's survival. You might have been the very best. I make this argument about presidents a lot. I think presidents often make campaign promises that are not at all feasible, and they don't realize that they're not feasible until they get to office. Closing Guantanamo Bay was a great example in the Obama administration. I don't think that he kept Guantanamo Bay open because he realized how important it was necessarily. I think he kept it open because he realized how near to impossible it would be to close it without there being other negative ramifications down the road. The president's hands are tied to a certain degree with the minimum amount of time that they're going to have in office, what they can accomplish there, and obviously working with Congress and the Senate. Again, this speaks to the reason why our congressmen, our senators, are the people that we need to be holding accountable for these things. And the way you hold them accountable is by voting.
Now, you do need to vote. I don't disagree with you, but what I will say is politicians will be what they are. And when our generals become politicians, you have disasters like we have unleashed in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I don't disagree one bit.
That's the problem of when generals, there's an article in there, when generals become politicians, there's your headline.
Right. I mean, I would argue like the result is never good in either regard, when politicians decide to become generals or when generals decide to become politicians. There's a reason why – my brother says this about race mechanics all the time. But he says, I expect you to be good at your job. That's why I pay you to do it, right? Generals and politicians have very specific jobs. They're difficult jobs that take an entire lifetime to get good at. That's the reason why – you can't enlist as a general. It's the reason why very rarely do you get elected president when you don't have some breadth of experience behind you, right? The idea needs to be that these are difficult jobs that require SMEs, absolutely. But I do not think that we're ever going to be able to write a policy or establish a recruiting procedure or even a voting procedure that's going to eliminate self-serving people, that's going to eliminate the way that you justify bad behavior in your mind, especially when it's on the fence about bad behavior, you know, like when it's one of those things where, like, it's arguably not your fault. You're certainly not going to absorb the blame in the public eye. We need to know this. We can't expect people to all be noble. We need to have a system that works even when the Knights of the Round Table are not at the Pentagon.
I don't know. I'd be curious to know what that system is because if you don't have people, I mean –
Honestly, I think that system looks like what we've got, which is a series of horrible disasters and then our efforts to mitigate them thereafter,
wow.
Right? I would argue that we have, as bad as this looks, we have had a lot of successes in that regard in the past century. We have not, to date, started another world war because of the lessons that we were able to leverage from the previous two, right? We are not learning our lessons from Vietnam. We are not learning our lessons from Afghanistan. But this might be part of the way that we learn those lessons as well, that we could theoretically leverage. I'd argue we're doing a bad job now of those post-World War II lessons, so maybe we're going to enter into an era of doing a great job when it comes to war on terror lessons and a terrible job of global war lessons. I really wish that we could keep our eye on more than one ball at a time, but I don't have a whole lot of faith in humanity left at this point. Be honest.
Yeah, that's what. Again, I think for all the systemic reasons you point to, right? That's why I think it's so important for the general officers of this nation to understand where they sit at these crossroads. I mean, consider American history. If Tommy Franks would have said, "Without you articulating for me, you know what this looks like, I can't do it. I won't do it." Because if they won't cause that kerfuffle and maybe they will be roadkill at the end of it, but that's the only way the system can work, because I just think politicians are flawed. And I think
I'd ask people to do this one thing for me. If with that approach, when you see news stories vilifying a service member because one politician thinks that he's after their party or a person in their party, disregard that bullshit headline and read the article to see. I'm not saying that no service member could ever have a political axe to grind.
Right.
But what I am saying is that we need, in that case, to accept the idea that you can be critical of something Donald Trump did without voting for him, without being a part of a vast anti-Trump conspiracy. You could be critical of something that Barack Obama did without being a Trump supporter. You can be critical of things because they were the wrong thing to do without any interest whatsoever for who you're affiliated with in terms of political party. Let's try to embrace that idea.
Well, you know, General Mattis talks about that. When he gave He gave a speech at the Al Smith Foundation dinner in New York City, and it's where he made the comment that got all over the news that, you know, that the president called him the most overrated general in history. And then General Mattis said, and he also called Meryl Streep the most overrated actress in history. He said, I guess, which makes me the Meryl Streep of general officers. And he said,
which is one of my favorite Mattis quotes. Right? He said, a lot of great Mattis
quotes. He said, I'm pretty good with that. He said, just so you know. But the rest of the speech was what you're talking about. It's this place where, and even his most recent comments about, we've got to stop this 4-year election cycle, right? That once we get beyond the election for a period of time, that we've got to get to the business of taking care of the nation and compromise, and then we can fight about it again. But during the interim, we've got to do business. That calls for articulate discourse, which is based on the fact that what you just said, just because you support Donald Trump's policies, right, doesn't mean you're a pinhead. Just because you don't like Barack Obama doesn't mean you're a racist or a hater, right?
Exactly.
And so, but we can't get to the point where we can even have that discussion today, you know?
And honestly, like, it's tragic to me because I have to say, I try to be optimistic. I know we always talk about the little engine that could. Our system has gotten so complicated and convoluted, and people have grown so cynical that I worry. I'm really worried that things aren't going to get better until something really bad happens that forces it.
And well,
I don't know what that big bad looks like. Yeah. Maybe it's a big war, something like that. But I fear that we're going to need a shock to our system to change, and I hope that that's not the case.
Well, and what you're talking about is a shock greater than magnitude of two of the tallest buildings in the country falling down on live TV and thousands of people.
Here we are. We're not that much further along from that. I was in high school when 9/11 happened, and I'm not that old a guy now. And here we are. Nobody gives a shit about Afghanistan.
We digested that, and the lessons that came out of 9/11 and the solidarity of the nation after that were quickly went aside, right, to business as usual. So,
and we're as divided as ever now.
Right. So what have you learned from all of that? So how big does a catastrophe have to be?
In all honesty, like that, what size catastrophe would we need to make us remember? You know, because I always cite there's a famous study that showed that among some Republicans, right, it was a few thousand people surveyed, Kim Jong-un was held in a higher esteem than Nancy Pelosi, right? Because in America, we now see the opposing party as a bigger threat to American ideals than we do despots like Kim Jong-un, which is insane to me, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do we do? How do we bridge that divide? You need an actual threat to your existence that is so dire that you realize that, hey, having a slightly different position on abortion doesn't necessarily make you my enemy. It just makes you a person with different life experiences. Maybe the fact that we both grew up in Michigan, the fact that we both work in the same type of mill, the fact that we both have daughters that go to public school, the fact that we both played football in high school, maybe some of these things that we all have in common matter more than these two or three divisive political positions that we've decided to live and die on, even though a lot of times these political positions don't even have anything to do with the platforms of our party. Nothing about being a Republican ever said you'd have an issue with climate science. Nothing about being a Democrat ever said that you'd have an issue with GMOs, right? We've just chosen cultural teams based on our politics. It's absolutely It blows my mind. The only thing that could bring us back together, I fear, might be something so dire that it threatens our very existence. Because threatening our comfort isn't enough, right? We've seen that, right? In the country, there's always those people who talk about a new civil war. As long as Netflix is streaming, there won't be a new civil war. People are comfortable, they're content, and they're happy, but they like hating each other online. Until we make their lives in danger, I'm not sure we're going to lose our love affair with outrage. I hope I'm wrong.
I worry that it's an invasion
or something.
I think you're right. So to me, when you look at this triangle, and then I want to ask you about your career here in a second. So when you look at this triangle of the American people, the American politician, and the American general, the only, in my opinion, the only thing that can change Politicians won't. The electorate will not until the nation, we go through another World War II or something like that that's that cataclysmic, right? And
so and what's awful about that is look at the global powers in the previous World Wars and how they fared following the World Wars. You know, I'm not saying England being a great example, I'm not saying that you have a huge fall from grace, but you certainly have a significant drop off. There's a precipitous drop off in diplomatic power and economic power following a war of that magnitude, especially if the U.S. was at the forefront of it, which means this challenge that we're talking about, that could potentially be the only thing that brings us back together, would have to hurt us so bad that America would not – it would barely be recognizable as compared to the America of today on the geopolitical
stage. So to me, the only thing that's in the realm is, you know, can we ask the general and flag officers of this country – that when these things are clearly outside the realm to do what General Shinseki did, you know, and I played that audio,
this is a great opportunity. You, as an officer, I think, are uniquely positioned to make that kind of demand where it's harder for me as an enlisted guy to understand, you know, you as a flag officer, what you're capable of. So you can leverage your side with the officer, and I would leverage my side to the enlisted guys out there with shovels in your hands, where I'd say, Max Wright, if those general officers can do their part, now it's time for us to do our part.
And I agree. And there's a reason that our oaths are different, right?
That's fair. That's a great point.
There's a reason. And that's what I'm saying. When you look at the macro, to me, discussion, that if we have people to go back, and when generals become politicians, right, that is deadly for the nation, and it's deadly for regions of the world where you have hundreds of thousands of civilian casualties that owe themselves for generals not willing to follow what General Shinseki said was how many people are going to be needed, right, to garrison Iraq post-war, right?
And
the war plan.
Let us not demand that generals be politicians so that Max's crew can do their job.
Well, again, exactly. And so to me, all General Shinseki did was told the truth about what the war plan said, and that was several hundred thousand. And it was true. And then he goes on to say, you have to understand, the factions inside of Iraq, the services that will have to be delivered, the transition to some other form of rule, holding all of that together is not a small task. And you listen to it now, and he says this in February 2003, and you just cringe when you hear it, because it's the fucking truth, right? It's the fucking truth. Now, it did not slow the elected leadership down. President Bush with Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, they had their own, the neocons had a view of what would happen, right? It was totally fucked up. And maybe if more people told the truth, like General Shinseki, like General Zinni,
right up through the executive branch, though. You know what I mean? Because Barack Obama was very literally handed a shit sandwich in Afghanistan the same way Donald Trump was. Neither president to date, to include Pentagon statements following the Afghanistan papers being made public, neither president to date has come out and said, even Donald Trump, who wants to end the Middle East wars while planning to send thousands more troops to the Middle East. Nobody has come out and said, this is an absolute debacle because this, and this. We've said lots of things, like about them being forever wars. Donald Trump's really good at sound bites. But no politician to date, I would argue, has put a point on what we've done wrong in Afghanistan either. And I think maybe that's part of it, is that even when we have elections, the Democrats and the Republicans were able to see eye to eye on not talking honestly about Afghanistan, so that they could talk about what they do in Afghanistan, right?
Well, and I wanted to play the audio from the Washington Post Live, but it's about 5 minutes. David Ignatius, a very reputable journalist, right? Huge reputation. He asked Mattis about the Afghanistan papers. Mattis says essentially there's nothing really new here, right? That this was discussed in circles. That's not the question. The question is, was it discussed and disclosed to the American people? So my point is, Ignatius is sitting there. So Ignatius asks a question. Mattis answers the part of the question that he wants to answer, right? And Ignatius doesn't want to do battle with Mattis in public, right? because you don't want to alienate that guy. And so he doesn't.
That's a bridge you don't want to burn.
Right. So as a journalist, you ask one question, Mattis answers a slight part of it, but a lot of another question, and then you let it go. And that's how this thing coexists. Okay? And
I don't know, though. I still am inclined to agree with James Mattis, though. I don't think that there's been any shortage of military leaders who got out and said Afghanistan was a nightmare. I don't think that there's been any shortage of disclosure to the American people. And when I say disclosure, I mean the same way the Afghanistan papers were disclosed, not formal government statements, but stories reaching the press, officials giving quotes to the press about what a nightmare, what a shit show Afghanistan has been for a very long time. And to be honest with you, we're not talking about these Afghanistan papers are not talking about operational commanders. We're talking about guys through the lens of hindsight, talking about how screwed up their old job was. You know, to their point, their old job was screwed up. The policy is absolutely screwed up. You know what I mean? But I am inclined to agree with Mattis that I think the only Americans who are surprised by the revelations in the Afghanistan papers are the ones that haven't been paying attention to Afghanistan.
Again, to me, that's not the question. The question,
That's fair.
To me, the question is, why wasn't there pushback? If this wasn't going to work and everybody fucking knew it, why was there no pushback at the highest levels?
I think a lot of people, you know, and we'll go back and forth in circles, but I think a lot of people really thought that eventually it would work. I think that's really what it comes down to, is that everybody thought they were writing Chapter 16, but Chapter 30 wasn't their problem. You know, and I think that's where a lot of this comes from. I don't think it was people intentionally acting through with nefarious intent. I think it was people going, I'm going to handle my share of this problem, and I don't know what the hell they're going to do 10 years from now, but that's not my problem, you know? And I think that that's where all
You're CENTCOM, that is your problem.
Well, yeah, but if you're the commander of CENTCOM, right, you got 3 years for it to be your problem.
Right, and that's your problem. So if it's in fact not winnable, right, and if our strategy isn't taking us there, do you have an obligation to say that or no?
I think you absolutely do. Again, though, I think that we probably would find that there is documentation of leaders trying to voice these kinds of concerns in the past. You know what I mean? Tactfully, of course, because they're talking to their own bosses. But I think that there is a difference between coming back and briefing Congress in a classified briefing than telling the Washington Post. And we need to understand and recognize that difference. It's a failure of Congress.
But I would love to hear one of them say, because let me tell you, a good example is Jack Keane. Jack Keane goes on Fox, and he, in my opinion, he tells the truth about the stuff he talks about. Now, supposedly that got him out of the Army early, but to me, that's the kind of guy
that... to be how things go when you are the one that tells the truth.
Very critical of President Trump and his Twitter and how we did, you know, the most recent events in Syria. But he tends to tell the truth. And so to me, that's the lesson of what you got to be. And you have to, I think, lest you become a politician, you have to come to grips with the fact that I may have to fall on my sword for this because that's congruent with the oath that I took. I cannot become a politician. And the problem, I would say...
And we need to agree as a populace that when a general decides to do that, when a general is willing to do that, that our immediate assumption won't be that it's got something to do with the next election cycle.
Yeah, I would... We've got to make that agreement
amongst ourselves where we go... I'm not saying that we won't investigate whether or not there's bias or there's, you know, political intrigue at play, but let's go... Okay, somebody's blowing a whistle. Somebody's trying to say something. Let's take a look at it before we decide whether or not they're a villain or a hero. Let's say that they don't even have to be either to give us information that's important to the nation. Let's say that the information matters. We want to make sure that the source is verifiable, that the information is true. But at the end of the day, whether or not that guy, what kind of porn he looks at or who he voted for in the last election is not the most important part of the conversation revolving around this information that he wants to share with us.
No, the truth is, right?
That's what we got to do. The truth is what matters.
The truth is what matters.
We're doing a bad job of that.
Exactly.
Right now.
The truth is what matters, and its implication for American interest in XYZ place around the globe. But that truth's got to be important. And I just, it's to me, because again, at the end of the day, what you're asking for is lance corporals you know, to walk out of a firm bases, to go into the attack, to go risk their lives, and then ultimately for us to shrug our shoulders and say, yeah, it didn't really work out.
Yeah, we never really
that,
cared enough.
That sucked. But let me, but I'm going to write a book about it and get an advance of about $15 million, and it's
and
all going to be
good. Meanwhile, we're going to go ahead and do the same thing now in Iran.
Right. Right. No, it's just
hopefully
no,
not.
It's
hopefully
just,
not.
It's discouraging. All right, you got. Do you want to talk about your professional life?
Yeah, we'll save it for another time. I do have a big announcement that I'll mention, but we can talk about it another time. But I will be leaving SoftRep at the end of this month. I have spent, I mean, 3 or 4 years now writing for this outlet and its sister sites, and it's treated me very well throughout. But it was time for me to make a change. So starting in January, I will be the new editor of a website being stood up by a company called Sandbox with two X's. The company and the new website I'll be building are based entirely on trying to benefit active duty service members and their families. It's really Sandbox itself is an app that helps get mail to active duty service members while they're either in training or in theater. You can actually go in the app and type a letter in your phone, upload a picture. They will print the letter and the picture and deliver it to your service member if they're at boot camp the next day. It really makes it a lot easier to get those morale letters out, but I'll be standing up a website for them that'll be a branch off of a pretty successful blog that they've been running, entirely with the goal of just being a resource for military family members, being a resource for those first few years of service when you're in the military. Right now, literally every Marine who goes through boot camp gets a Sandbox account as a part of their accession pipeline. So it's a chance for me to reconnect with my roots.
Wow.
I'm really stoked about it. So please, by all means, already go check out Sandbox, SandBoxX.us. Right now, you can click on their blog and check out the awesome work that's already up there. There's a really cool Marine spouse named Nicole, who is their head of marketing, who's been in charge of putting content up on their blog for the past year. There's already lots of great stuff on there, but especially for Marines, this company was founded by a Marine general and a Marine sergeant. My peers are Marine spouses and former Marines. It's like going home for me. I'm really excited about this change. So by all means, guys, go check it out. I definitely think the All-Marine Radio audience, even though you guys mostly tend to be fat old vets like me, I think you could still get some benefit out of going and checking it out.
What's up with the F word? All right, next question. Would it surprise you to know that, like, I build computers?
That would surprise. That's awesome, man. I my work computer, I say I built because I stood next to my brother while he did it.
What? that's close. I wanted it to be more of a beast, right?
Yeah.
And so I
so
went
you're expanding your skill set, right?
I went and I to my local computer parts store, bought the box, the motherboard, CPU, RAM, and then I had the other stuff already in my computer. But yeah,
that's awesome, man. Well done.
Well, let me just tell you, for less than $500, the thing's a beast.
When it's time for me to upgrade, you'll be hearing from me, because I can't figure out how to make the headphone jack work on this computer that I quote-unquote built.
Oh, my God. That's a problem. That's never mind. Candy Graham.
There's a reason why I'm always communicating with you via USB-powered headphones.
All right. We want to get your brother-in-law involved? Or?
Yeah, well, my brother, my younger brother, but he lives out in L.A. He's one of you weird California people. So it's
you
hard
might want
to
get him involved in it. So not saying, just saying. All right. Is there anything else I haven't
asked? No, just make sure you guys all come and follow me on social media, especially now that I will be leaving SoftRep. You can still find my content on SoftRep here through the end of the year. I'm going to hang out until the end of the end of December. But if you want to follow me so that you can see my new work on Sandbox, I'll still be writing for Popular Mechanics as well. But it's facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter. On Twitter, it's @AlexHollings52. On Instagram, if you want to follow me, it's Archetype52. But that's mostly just pictures and knives I'm making and my kid being cute. Wow. But check out AlexHollings.com for updates. And I'm really excited about this new thing, but it really is my job to build this site into something, into a digital destination. So Please, by all means, check out the website. Check it out even more in January once I've landed and I'm at the helm. I'm really excited about this opportunity. If you've got ideas, if you think there's something that could benefit the Marine Corps or the military community at large, let me know. My whole goal here is to be a positive voice in the military world, because there's plenty of negative out there. I'm really excited about being a reason to be in a good mood.
Wow. Listen to that.
Extending that Christmas season vibe, man. You know, keep growing it. Keep growing it until I restore my faith in humanity.
We're not used to it. All right, Alex Hollings here, an extended version. Thanks for the visit. I'll talk to you.
Hey, thanks a lot, brother. I'm always happy to be on.
No, congratulations, too. Very happy for you and your continued success. We've watched you grow. And so,
this is, I think, like the third time I've made like an exclusive career announcement on here. And I feel like everybody who's listening is like, I don't even know who the hell this guy is. Why do I care? But to me, it's a big deal, guys. All right.
No. We're huge fans of, and again, everybody from your UFO riding to the other things you do, you have a lot of fans here. So appreciate, the extended
I appreciate
visit
anybody
this
who will listen to my bullshit.
Exactly. All right, man.
Grateful for every bit of it. Thanks, Mac.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, brother.
There you go. Didn't know he liked Christmas that much. Alex Hollings here Monday morning. Anyway. Let me read you an email. Ohio man showed up this morning. It's entitled Crazy. This OK symbol thing is out of control. There was nothing nefarious going on. You could see one MIDI stifling a laugh and doing his best not to look at the OK on his shoulder coming from behind him. The people that are calling this a white power thing are nuts. One of my fellow team members did it in our football team photo 37 years ago. The coach chewed his ass real good. Good grief, the world is nuts. I don't even know what it means, okay? And so, but to me, right, if that is a thing, and if you're doing it, then you're wrong. There's no daylight on that. So if that's a thing, and you did it, then I can't save you from that one. Shithole weather update. Woke up to 3 inches of snow here in central Ohio. Just watched the new Top Gun trailer. I'm sure Alex will geek out about it. Also, I'm being transferred to an Indiana plant effective next year. Does that make me Indiana man? Hoosier man? No, he's Ohio man. Once you get tagged, you're tagged, right? Once you get tagged, you're tagged. Let me read you another email. Mac, it's interesting. Alex is relying on the voter to change, to be more concerned, and to elect politicians that are better. Your perspective is politicians will be what politicians are. While I understand Alex's sentiment, I'm more in line with what you say. I don't think politicians can be anything what they are. It's interesting, how would they go back to the way that General Mattis is talking about it? ? I'm not exactly sure. Does that mean they have to ignore the reporting from CNN and Fox? How they're portrayed in their district? Do they have to compromise and brave those primaries? Is that the only thing? I can tell you this, I believe the people in the country are fed up with what we get out of Washington, D.C. In my lifetime, the approval rating from Congress, in parentheses, I'm not sure what it is today, continues to plummet. And there's no way that we can change that. I'm not sure how we get to the vision General Mattis has for the country. A vision I think most of us would say is where we need to go. We don't seem to be able to pull out of this nosedive the nation is relative to its political health. It gets uglier and nastier every year. I keep my fingers crossed, but I think in that world that generals have a more than important position because the rest of it's not going to change. It's not a very positive picture. I appreciate the discussion today between you and Alex. Yeah, I'm uncomfortable with it. I just, during the program, I just did a search on the words Tommy Franks and failure. Here's what came back. One is written by Tom Ricks, formerly of the Washington Post. It's called General Failure. From the New York Times, occupation plan for Iraq faulted in Army history. Now, here's the problem with the article, right? And this is written by one of my guys, Michael Gordon. I love Michael Gordon. He's awesome. So anyway, yeah, Michael Gordon's a guy I always talk about, the guy who tells the truth. Is that the war plan called for something completely different. And Rumsfeld tore up the war plan, and the CENTCOM commander said, okay, yeah, no problem. So, faced with that decision, that's what you're going to allow to go forward. Yeah. The Brookings Institute, Iraq without a plan. From foreignpolicy.com, what makes a general great? CBS News, General Zinni, they've screwed up. Anyway, just some interesting reading. So what happens when at the top of the pyramid, when people don't tell the truth, when those debates don't take place, and the world is still suffering for it. So anyway. Back in the high. If you're just tuning in, I had a big weekend. Yep, I did. You're going to be able to hear me discuss putting up my Christmas lights, building a computer, and doing a ton of yard work. I even did windows yesterday. Yeah, how crazy is that? And I'm embarrassed to say it, but I'll say it. I think that's the first time I've washed the windows in this house since I moved into it 3.5 years ago. I'm not exactly sure, but I might. I'm pretty sure. Come on, it rains. What the hell? So, yeah. Yeah, and that takes a little bit of time. Anyway, have a great day on a Monday from a new computer. Yeah, it's really powerful and really quiet. All Marine Radio. Over and out.